Paramahamsa Parivrajakacharya Asatara Satashri Srimad Divine Grace Esi Bhakti Vedanta Swami Maharaj Prabhupada Ki Jai. ISKCON Founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Anantakoti Vaishnava Vrinda Ki Jai. Nam Acharya Srila Haridas Thakur Ki Jai. Prem Shikaho Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Adwaita Gadadhar Shri Vasadi Gaur Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai. Shri Shri Radha Krishna Go Gopina Shaimakunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhana Ki Jai. Vrindavan Dhamma Ki Jai. Mathura Dhamma Ki Jai. Navadvip Mayapur Dhamma Ki Jai. Jagannath Puri Dhamma Ki Jai. Gangamai Jamuna Devi Ki Jai. Bhakti Devi Ki Jai. Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai. Samaveda Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai. Gaur Premanande. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Vastai Budale. Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane. Namaste Sarasvati Deve. Gauravani Pacharani Nirvasesa Sanyavani Paskatyade Satarane. Mandeham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Padakamalam Sri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raganatam Vitam Samsajivam Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Padijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakam Vitamscha. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. It's August 22nd, 2013 in Hilo, Hawaii, class over Skype. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 8, Prayers by Queen Kunti and Parikit Save, Text 11. Suta Uvacha Upadarya Vachastasya Bhagavan Bhakta Vatsalaha Apandavam Idam Kartam Dronir Astram Abhuchita. Suta Uvacha. Suta Goswami said, Upadarya, by hearing her patiently, Vachaha, words, Tasyaha, Bhagavan, the personality of Godhead, Bhakta Vatsalaha, he who is very much affectionate toward his devotees, Apandavam, without the existence of the Pandava's descendants, Idam, this, Kartum, to do it, Dronehe, of the son of Dronacharya, Astram, weapon, Abhudyata, understood. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Suta Goswami said, having patiently heard her words, Lord Sri Krishna, who is always very affectionate to his devotees, could at once understand that Asvatthama, the son of Dronacharya, had thrown the Brahmastra to finish the last life in the Pandava family. Purport. The Lord is impartial in every respect, but still he is inclined towards his devotees, because there is a great necessity of this for everyone's well-being. The Pandava family was a family of devotees, and therefore the Lord wanted them to rule the world. That was the reason he vanquished the rule of the company of Duryodhan and established the rule of Maharaj Yudhisthir. Therefore, he also wanted to protect Maharaj Prickett, who was lying in embryo. He did not like the idea that the world should be without the Pandavas, the ideal family of devotees. Sutta Uvacha Upadarya Vachastasya Bhagavan Bhaktivatsalaha Apandavam Idam Kartum Dronyer Astram Abhudyata. Sutta Goswami said, having patiently heard her words, Lord Sri Krishna, who is always very affectionate to his devotees, could at once understand that Aswatthama, the son of Dronacharya, had thrown the Brahmastra to finish the last life in the Pandava family. So here is a topic that's brought up many times in the Bhagavatam, especially in the seventh canto. How is it that the Lord is Bhaktivatsal? Doesn't this make him whimsical and partial? You know, is it just that the good people are the people who like him and the bad people are the people who don't like him? You know, in this world, we're very much caught up in this conflict between good and bad. Such a large portion of our stories, our entertainment, our political news is focused on this, who's a good person and who's a bad person. And those of us who want to be good persons, we have to figure out, you know, what is it that makes a person good? When I used to be running a Gurukula, I would have to get books for the children to read. You can't teach children to read without having them read something. And because there weren't that many directly Krishna conscious books available, so I would review a lot of other books. I tried to take mostly religious books from different religious systems or books that had some moral instruction. And of course, Prabhupada wanted the children to read some of the classics, as he said in a conversation with Hayagriva. But one of the criteria, the head of the education ministry at the time worked with me on having a set of criteria for what would be a suitable book. And part of our criteria was how the author handled good and bad. Who was a good person, who was a bad person. I mean, this is very relevant here because at the end of this chapter, there's at least two, perhaps more purports, where Prabhupada says that Duryodhana was not a bad king in a technical sense. So he wasn't somebody like, you know, Stalin or Idi Amin or Saddam Hussein, or, you know, the people we think of in the modern day as these, how would you say, definite demons that nobody can argue. I mean, I suppose somebody likes Hitler and somebody likes Stalin and somebody likes Idi Amin, but pretty much people who are universally accepted as evil. So it wasn't that Duryodhan was in that category. He wasn't some sort of a sadist who was torturing people just for the sake of doing so and that way. In fact, he did make sure that the citizens were well taken care of in many respects. But yet, here Srila Prabhupada is explaining why did Krishna want Duryodhan removed. This is something that Yudhisthira himself doesn't understand. And as again, at the end of this chapter and moving on to the next chapter, Yudhisthira is convinced that the only reason that the war was fought was for his personal sense gratification and personal prestige. And he was convinced that actually, I'm not any better than Duryodhan. Duryodhan was a fine king. What was the problem? Why should so many people die and such havoc and a war and so many things just to put me on the throne when Duryodhan was just fine? But here we're seeing what is really the difference between good and bad. I mean, I remember in these books that I was reviewing, not always, but often, there was some sort of a conflict between good and bad, sometimes within the individual themselves, you know, man against himself, as they put it in literary circles, and sometimes between one person and another, sometimes between groups of a person or groups of entities. I noticed certain trends. I noticed that it was not uncommon for the good and the bad to be different species or have some different bodily characteristics.
you know, that all the good people were beautiful and all the bad people were ugly, or, you know, the good people came from one planet and the bad people came from another. The good people were a particular race and the bad people were another race. And there was one book in particular which was part of a very popular series. I can't remember the book anymore. I didn't like it at all. I remember I didn't put it in the library and I didn't get the rest of the series, where the good characters were mice and the bad characters were rats. And what I didn't like about the particular book was that it didn't establish why the rats were evil. They were just evil because they were evil. Basically, the authors said they were evil, they were the bad guys, and so they were the bad guys. In fact, in a lot of normal dealings, it's exactly like that. You know, the good guys are my own countrymen. And the bad guys are anyone who's against my country. That makes them bad. You know, I'm an American, so Americans are good. And if the Russians are against America, they're bad. Pretty simple. You know, that comes down to I'm good, and anyone who's with me is good, and anyone who's against me is bad. You know, something like your sports team. Oh, I live in St. Louis, and therefore the St. Louis team is the best, and whoever's fighting St. Louis is bad. Pretty simple. So we can think that God is like that. You know, it's also interesting that when we think in those terms, that anyone who's on my side, you know, my family is good, my country is good, my city is good, the business I work for is good, the school that I went to is good, and others are automatically bad because they're not me. And when we think like that, then we interpret people's behavior differently. If I gave this example on the other class on Balaram's appearance day about Jarasandhar, that Jarasandhar didn't interpret Kamsa's killing of his nephews and imprisoning his father, imprisoning his sister and brother-in-law, he didn't interpret that as bad, but he interpreted Krishna killing Kamsa, his maternal uncle, as bad. So, you know, somehow Krishna is evil for killing his relative, especially a superior relative, but Kamsa is not evil for imprisoning his father and for killing newborn babies. So we all do this kind of thing, that if somebody's on our side, we see what they do wrong as necessary. We see that the end justifies the means. So Jarasandhar is thinking, well, Kamsa had to kill his nephews and imprison his father for his own protection. But he doesn't see that Krishna killed Kamsa for his own protection or for the protection of his own people or for the good of the citizens. So again, we all tend to do like that. You know, as Mahatma Prabhu said the other day, that we judge our own intentions and we judge others' behaviors. And it's the same with the good and the bad. If somebody's on my side, then I look at their intentions. And if somebody's not on my side, then I look at their behaviors. And we're very much caught up in this friends and enemies mentality. Now, Prahlad Maharaj preached that having this friends and enemies mentality is one of the key signs of a materialistic person. And of course, throughout the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that the devotee should be neutral towards friends and enemies. The devotee should see the friends, enemies, and neutral parties equally, not thinking, oh, this person is my friend because they help me out, this person is my enemy because they want to do me harm, and this person is neutral because they neither help me nor do me harm. So if that's a materialistic mentality, a sign of a conditioned soul, and the absence of that thinking is what makes a liberated soul. So a conditioned soul thinks whoever helps me is my friend, whoever hurts me is my enemy, whoever does neither is neutral, and I interpret their behavior differently, and I see my friends as good and my enemies as bad. Of course, the people who are my enemies would see it in reverse. The people my enemies, they see my enemies as good and my friends as bad. There's not an absolute standard. So if this is true for the jiva, that a jiva who perceives like this is an illusion and a jiva who doesn't perceive like this is in reality, then what's the situation with God? how is it that God is called Bhaktivatsala, as described here in this verse? In fact, Rupa Goswami explains that this quality of Bhaktivatsala is Krishna's most wonderful quality, that it trumps all of his other qualities, and that he is willing to put his other qualities aside for the sake of Bhaktivatsala. But how is that? How does that make sense? I mean, we think about this argument given many times in regard to Krishna, that how can Krishna's relationship with the gopis be ordinary sexuality when the pure devotees are above ordinary sexuality? The pure devotees are above lust. So how can Krishna, the object of their devotion, be subject to lust? So in the same way, if the devotees are above this friends, enemies, and neutral party mentality, how can Krishna have it? How is that possible? The kids here have a book of the demigod stories from various cultures. And you find that in such stories, this friends and enemies mentality is very prevalent. And this sort of whimsicalness where, you know, the demigods help people who worship them and they don't help people who don't worship them. And many people think of God like this. That, okay, I go to church, I go to a temple, I go to a mosque, I go to a synagogue, whatever, I go to my place of worship. And I flatter God. I flatter him. I tell him how wonderful he is. All glories to you. And then he's going to favor me. He's going to do what I want rather than what my enemies want. You know, God, it will be on my side. And if I don't just have to flatter him, maybe I have to bribe him. So I flatter him, tell him how wonderful he is, and then I bribe him. I give him fruits. I give him money. I give him my time and energy, and I think in that way I'll be able to get him to do what I want. So what is this partiality, and what is it with favoring devotees? You know, partiality generally means not meritocracy. Just like we have this word nepotism. Nepotism means that you put people in positions of power and authority because they're your family or because they're your friends, even though they are not qualified. You're favoring loyalty to yourself over qualification. And in many parts of the world, that's illegal. Or the whole idea of taking bribes. I mean, in some cultures, bribes are part of the culture. But the concept of bribes being illegal is that it's unfair. You know, it gives people who have more money some kind of an advantage. It means that the rules aren't being applied fairly. The rules aren't there for the sake of the rules. So generally, partiality is seen, first of all, as really unfair. It means that people who aren't qualified get positions because they have more money or because they have more connections. And it also is seen as being harmful. Because if you put somebody in a position who's not qualified just because they're your friend, then they're going to cause harm for others. Right? The unfairness is going to be a source of harm. So if I can't get a visa because I can't pay the bribe, then somebody who's really should be in the country and should be contributing can't do so. But here Srila Prabhupada is saying that Krishna is inclined towards the devotees because there is a great necessity of this for everyone's well-being. So that Krishna's being partial to his devotees is for the sake of doing good to everyone. It isn't a case of, well, if you like God, you know, it's just like people have this idea that if you say, God, I believe in you, I surrender to you, you go to heaven. If you say, God, I don't believe in you, you go to hell. That's not our view, by the way, in the Bhagavatam. We do not say that. In fact, there are subterranean heavenly planets for the demons. So even the demons, even the atheists, even those who hate God, can go to heaven. And the demons that Krishna kills can go to the Brahmajyoti. Some of them even go to Vaikuntha. So we don't say like this. We don't say that Krishna rewards those who love him and he punishes those who hate him in the way that a materially conditioned soul does. That's not what we say at all. When this question is asked in the seventh canto, the answer is, and the story is given of at that time of Nrisingadev and Prahlad and Hiranyakashipu, the answer that's given is that all of creation favors the mode of goodness. And what appears to be partiality, is simply that everything favors goodness. Oh, here we have the word but in the first sentence. I don't know if that was Prabhupada's original word. But Prabhupada is saying here, the Lord is impartial in every respect, but still he's inclined towards his devotees. So this being inclined towards his devotees is not a denial of his impartiality. It's not a denial of his neutrality. Krishna is not favoring in a nepotism way that Krishna is going to put his devotees in charge just because they like him and he likes them, even though the devotees will cause havoc. It's not like that. So when we say that Krishna favors his devotees, we say the universe favors goodness. What does this mean? So we have to understand, what does it mean to be a devotee? And what does it mean to be in goodness? So we come back to the concept that's mentioned in this verse, Bhagavan. Krishna is Bhagavan. Krishna is God. He is the supreme truth. Satyam Param Dhimahi. I meditate on Satya, the truth, Param, the supreme truth. The truth is Satya. Satya has several meanings. One of them is what's true. One of them is good, like Sattva Gun. And one of them is eternal. What's true is always true, and what's true is good. So a very simple example suffices. So what's good for the body? What kind of food is good for the body? It's food that's in harmony with the body. I mean, it depends what kind of body you have. If you're an anteater, if you've got an anteater body, then ants are good. If you have a tiger body, then meat is good. If you have a rabbit body, then, you know, vegetables are good. What's good is something that's in harmony with how things are. That's what's good. A door is good to walk through. A wall is good to hold up the building. A door is not good to hold up a building, and a wall is not good to walk through. So good and bad means what is in harmony with what is. What is reality? And as the closer you get to being in harmony with reality, the more good you are. And the more good you are, the better you are for your welfare and the welfare of everyone else. Right? It's just like, I notice that certain places that I go, I'm particularly healthy. In certain places I go, I'm not particularly healthy. So to a large extent, it depends on what I'm eating. Right? If I'm eating food that's in harmony with bodily health, then I'm going to feel more bodily health and more energized. So anyone in the universe who is supplying, shall we say, nutritious food for themselves and others, they're going to be beneficial for the universe. And everything in creation will favor them. Just like my body will favor healthy food and good exercise and sunlight, etc. So in the same way, the universal body, which is nothing other than the Lord himself, will favor those who are acting in harmony. And of course, the universal body, the universal soul, as Kunti goes on in this chapter, that Krishna is the soul of souls, is Krishna, is a person. Therefore, being in harmony with truth and in harmony with reality goes beyond just simply acting in a certain way. See, if the demons act in a certain way, if they follow the laws of karma and the laws of the universe, they also get to go to heaven. They may also even get to rule. This is Rupa Goswami describes Krishna's quality of being dependable. that even the demons know if we follow the rules, Krishna's not going to kill us. I mean, even in a modern democracy, it's like that. You can hate the government. You can even get up and decry the government. But as long as you're following the laws, the government's not going to arrest you. That's one of the differences. You know, democracy is not just about voting, but at least in America, one of the differences between American government and some other forms of government is that we have protected free speech. And protected free speech is particularly that you're allowed to criticize the government without any sort of retribution from the government, as long as you follow the rules. So Krishna is also like that. You can be a demon and you can hate him, but as long as you follow the rules, then you're going to get the result of your good karma. But truth is more than that. Truth is more than that. Because the absolute truth is a person. Brahmeti Bhagavaneti. Brahmeti Paramatmeti Bhagavaneti Sabjite. The ultimate expression of truth, the ultimate expression of reality, is not simply a series of laws. Because the ultimate reality is not mechanical. The demons think that ultimate reality is mechanical. They think if you just follow a certain set of rules, you just live in a certain way, you just act in a certain way, then you will prosper. And if you act in another way, you will not prosper. And there's many so-called spiritualists who preach things like that. You know, I don't know if it's still popular, but for it was a while there was this New Agey philosophy that was very popular, that if you simply ardently desire something, you will get it. And to some extent, that's true. In an ultimate sense, it is true. Although you may also have to work for it by your karma. You can't just desire. You have to desire and demonstrate that desire in your actions. But the point is, they're thinking it's mechanical. Such people see, even though they appear to be very spiritual, some of the demons appear also to be very spiritual. Hiranyakashipu was talking a lot about how you're not this body. Many of the demons preach impersonalistic philosophy. So the demons are thinking like this, that the universe is a wish-fulfilling machine, and if you just know how to wish properly, you just know how to act properly or how to wish properly, then you'll get what you want and you'll have power and influence. So they're seeing a portion of the truth, undoubtedly so. Eko bhagnam yo vidadati kama. They're seeing that Krishna is a wish-fulfilling gem, that Krishna is a desire-fulfilling tree, and they're seeing that the universe operates according to some laws. I mean, even modern atheists understand this kind of thing. Even the modern evolutionists, they're spending their time trying to understand what are the universal laws. Of course, they don't understand subtle laws of karma, but they're trying to understand, at least on the gross platform, what are the laws? How does the universe work? And if we could just figure it out, then we could conquer birth, death, old age, and disease and become supremely powerful. But they don't know that that's not the whole story. That's not the ultimate expression of the absolute truth. They're dealing with Brahman or maybe Paramatma, but they're not dealing with Bhagavan. When you come to the ultimate expression of truth, you come to a person. And this is logically consistent with our everyday experience, that beyond the laws, there's lawmakers, there's persons. And in every body of lawmakers, there's a supreme person. You will not find simply a committee. You will find a committee chair. You'll find somebody who has the ultimate say. As our former President Bush said, I am the decider. There's an ultimate decider. And what is the laws? What are the meaning of the laws? How can the laws be applied? And one who's in harmony with Bhagavan is fully in line with truth. Therefore, everything favors such a person. And everything includes, of course, the ultimate manifestation of truth, Bhagavan himself. So Bhagavan himself favors those who are most in harmony with him, because he is absolute truth. He's a person, but he's not a person in the ordinary sense. I mean, the reason that we have this concept of friends and enemies is that we're dependent, or we believe we're in illusion, we believe that we're dependent on others in order to supply what we need. and protect what we have, yoga kshema, we're very much in this illusion that, you know, there was that Beatles song, I Get By With a Little Help from My Friends. So we think like that. We think that without my friends and family, I'm not going to be able to get what I need. I'm not going to be able to get what I want. We think my friends are facilitating getting what I want, and my enemies are hindering it, and the neutral parties are doing neither. So we are loyal to our friends and families really out of self-interest and out of illusory self-interest. So Krishna doesn't have a self-interest like that. Krishna's not dependent on anyone to give him what he wants or what he needs in any way whatsoever. When Lord Brahma stole all the boys and calves, Krishna just expanded himself as boys and calves. Even if you say Krishna is dependent on us for a relationship, it's not a fact. It's not that if we're not reciprocating with Krishna, I mean, if you think about how many living entities are in the material world, it's kind of mind-boggling, right? Just on 1 acre of land, how many living entities are there not reciprocating with Krishna? But it's not that Krishna's in some sort of lack. You know, he feels some compassion for those living entities who are out of harmony with truth, but he's not personally missing something. So Krishna doesn't have some sort of motive like that, that he's missing something and therefore he's partial to his friends who give him what he wants and he's partial against his enemies who deny him what he wants. Krishna always has everything that he wants. As we say, even the liberated souls always have everything that they want. Atmaranas chamunayo. So that's not what it is. It's a natural thing. It's logical, it's reasonable, it's natural that things favor that which are in harmony with themselves. Right? That our body favors that which is designed to work with the body. So the universe and creation and everything favors those who are in harmony with it, who are in harmony with how it functions, how it works. So although Duryodhan was a good king in the sense of the rules, he wasn't really a good king. I mean, we see just in his willingness to kill the Pandavas in order to secure his own position that his ultimate interest was his own power. He would benefit the citizens simply as a way of buying their loyalty, not because he really wanted to benefit them. And most importantly, he wasn't going to engage the citizens in the ultimate benefit of sacrifice for Vishnu. Ashradaya hutam tatam tapastatam kritam tayat asad ichuchate parta natchatat pretino iha. Anything done as sacrifice, charity, or penance without faith in the Supreme is impermanent and useless in this life and the next. Useless how? If you do sacrifice, austerity, and penance without faith in the Supreme just because you believe in the law of karma, yeah, you will get good karma in this life and the next. So why does Krishna say useless? Asat. It's not true. It doesn't provide your ultimate benefit. Maybe it gets you a nicer dream in this life and the next, but it's not true. It's not real. Therefore, asat. Therefore, Duryodhan, who was performing sacrifice, austerity, and penance, and doing good for others and all that, but without faith in the Supreme, he hated the Supreme. He wanted to destroy the Supreme. Therefore, it was actually useless. It wasn't really benefiting anybody. Therefore, Krishna wants persons in position of authority who are going to give real benefit to others. And that's not partiality. That's just reality. Reality is wanting what is beneficial. So that's real good and bad. One can see levels of good and bad. One can say what the person who's good is the one who follows the rules. And we say that in chapter 16 of Bhagavad Gita. Prabhupada says the demons are the ones who break the rules of Shastra and the demigods are the ones who follow the rules of Shastra. Okay, we can say like that. But ultimately, the real good is those who have a loving relationship of service with Krishna. Because that is reality. The ultimate reality is a person. Ultimate reality is personal. And therefore, those who are in ultimate reality are engaged in a proper relationship as persons. And it is for that reason that Krishna's quality of bhaktivatsal trumps all of his other qualities. Krishna will sacrifice anything for that personal loving relationship. And isn't that what we would want reality to be? Don't we want ultimate love, or ultimate reality, the ultimate expression of truth, to be a personal loving relationship of selfless service? Is there something else we'd want as ultimate reality? Would we want ultimate reality simply to be a rule book applied so-called impartially? Do we want evil people who follow the rules to be in positions of power just because they follow the rules? No, it's not what we want. And the evidence, the fact that we want ultimate reality to be about loving, giving, selfless, personal reciprocation and relationships is a good piece of evidence for the fact that that is the ultimate reality. So in looking at ourselves and others, that is the ultimate judgment of who is a good person. Therefore, in Bhagavad Gita 9:30, Apitet Sucharacharo, where Krishna says, even if a saintly person isn't following all the rules, even if a saintly person does something, even if my devotee does something that by the strict rules is not good, still they should be considered a saint. Now, of course, if somebody is in loving service with Krishna, we would assume that naturally they would follow Krishna's rules. I mean, if I love you, I'm going to do things the way that you want. Right? How could it be? How could someone be both united with the Lord in loving service and yet not doing what the Lord wants? This was Prabhupada's criticism of the Christians. He was asking one mock debate with his disciples, you know, what's wrong with the Christians? And they were giving so many reasons, and finally said, they do not obey. Christ said, thou shalt not kill, and they're killing. Okay. But sometimes, someone who's a devotee may not be obeying a lower level of rules. Just like in the discussion between Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Ramananda Roy, and Krishna's asking, how do you attain the ultimate goal of life? And Ramananda Roy starts with, just follow Varnashram. And then he says, follow Varnashram and offer everything to Krishna. Then he says, renounce Varnashram and become a sannyasi. Then he says, worship the Lord with knowledge. Then he says, worship the Lord free of jnana and karma. Then he says, have pure prema for the Lord. And he says, have pure prema as a servant. So Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu did not accept the lower concepts, Varnashram offered to Krishna, renunciation of Varnashram, bhakti mixed with jnana. He said these are external. Because of that, sometimes a devotee may jettison a lower rule for a higher rule. This is nicely explained in the purport to 9:30. And when a devotee does so, they will appear to have done something very abominable in human society. So some examples in this of the Shastra are Prahlad Maharaj garlanding and welcoming Nisingadev, who had just killed his father. And generally, if someone kills your father, you don't honor them. Bali Maharaj, who didn't follow the instructions of Sukracharya, the wives of the Brahmanas, who left their husband's shelter and protection and went to see Krishna, and then were accepted by their husbands when they returned as guru. It says the husbands saw their wives as guru. So these things may seem abominable from a material point of view. You know, for myself, in order to join the Hare Krishna movement, I had to disobey my mother. My father was supportive, but my mother was not. So to disobey your mother is most abominable. Krishna says that those in the mode of goodness, they worship the mother and father and other superiors. But in order to surrender to Krishna, I had to disobey my mother. So that kind of abominable. Prabhupada discusses this in 9:30. Therefore, when we're judging other people, are they good or are they bad? The main thing we look for is this person trying sincerely to be a loving servant of the Supreme? They may have difficulty in this or that, or they may be imperfect in this or that, and especially in Kali Yuga. In Kali Yuga, we should expect that people are going to have difficulty. It's just part of Kali Yuga. And this is also how we should look at ourselves. If we're going to judge, how good am I? So we can look at how good am I technically following the rules. And that's important. You cannot say, I love Krishna, but I'm going to disobey his instructions. But just following the rules and regulations technically is not really the measure of how good we are. What's really the measure of how good we are is how much am I developing a loving relationship with the person Krishna. And the more I do that, the more I come to total health. The more I come to total reality. And the more everything then is working in my favor. So questions or comments, corrections, additions, etc.
This is Prabhupada. I might ask a question.
Sure.
You spoke earlier, Mataji, about friends and enemies. I'm getting an echo here. Is that me or something else or what?
What's happening also is it's coming from your speaker and then going back into my microphone, and there's nothing I can do about that if I want to record it.
All right, let me turn down my speaker then. You spoke earlier about how persons with materialistic visions, they see friends and enemies, and how one with equal vision does not make such distinction. And so sometimes as devotees, we feel we need to associate more with like-minded devotees. Is that the same thing or what?
Oh, I'm so happy you asked that question. Well, that's some of our injunctions. In fact, it's interesting, in the Upadeshamrita, there's a list of six things given that are unfavorable for bhakti, and then six things given that are favorable for bhakti. And in both lists, it says don't associate with ordinary people. Even in the favorable list, you know, you've got the six favorable things, but one of them is also a negative. Don't associate with ordinary people. And when Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was asked, what is the main quality of a Vaishnava? He says, asat sanga tyag. Okay, but let's look at this. Asat sanga. Again, we're having this word sat. Sat, which means truth. Truth or goodness or eternal. Stay away from things that are false. That's the principle. If we want, just like Prabhupada said, if you want to enter into fire, you have to become fire. So if we want to become one, not in the sense of merging, but if we want to become one with the absolute truth, in the sense of oneness of interest, harmony of interest, then we have to associate with truth and not associate with falsity. So in that respect, there are persons who are exemplifying falsity, and therefore we avoid their association. But that's quite different than saying, this person is my friend because they facilitate my sense gratification, and this person is my enemy because they harm my sense gratification. And by the way, we can certainly get in that friends and enemies mentality in the name of Krishna consciousness. You can do practically any materialistic nonsense in the name of spirituality. You can have a weave that looks just like the bhakti creeper, and you're nourishing that thinking you're nourishing bhakti. So we can definitely get into that. We can get into an us and them mentality. And that's the sign of the Kanista Adhikari. The Kanista Adhikari is involved in factions, my group, your group, this people, that people, my temple, your temple, you know, my temple's better than your temple, which is what I was talking about at the beginning. My football team's better than your football team. My nation's better than your nation. So the devotee doesn't have any hatred towards anyone, even toward the asat. The devotee doesn't hate the asat. But we want to respond with them differently. It's just like, you know, why do I drink the water in the cup and not try to drink the cup? It's not because I hate the cup or I see the cup as my enemy, but I see that the cup is not designed for ingestion into my body. You know, some people have a disease. There's a disease called pica or pica, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, where people are craving something that's not food, often metal or lead, and their craving eventually kills them. So we don't want to ingest something that's not food, which in modern society is really a challenge because a lot of the stuff in the grocery store that looks like food and tastes something like food and smells something like food is not food. And this is true in our association also. We don't want to ingest something that's not food, that's not going to nourish us. That doesn't mean we hate it. It doesn't mean we see that those jivas are our enemy. Seeing someone as our enemy means we seek to do them harm. Seeing someone as our friend means we seek to do them good. So the devotee seeks to do good to everyone. The devotee doesn't seek to harm anyone. He for whom no one is put into any difficulty and who is not disturbed by anyone. So, you know, I don't seek to harm my cup just because it's not food. I know there's a place for it. So the devotee doesn't seek to harm anyone. The devotee doesn't harm anyone by their body, mind, or words. Even when Krishna kills the demons, he's not harming them. He's elevating them. Of course, in the present age, we're not supposed to even kill demons. Now, how you're going to benefit a demon and how you're going to benefit a devotee will be different. And how you'll benefit people who are more like-minded and who are not so like-minded will be different. I mean, in terms of what's food, it's not only that there's a certain category of stuff that's food for humans in general, but according to Ayurveda, there's certain things that are food for particular people. I mean, just a very interesting observation. My grandson's planning on going to India alone, and he was asking me how to avoid getting sick. So I was researching. I mean, I've always had my particular protocol I follow for not getting sick in India, but I knew that what I do wasn't going to be something that he was willing to do. So I was doing some research about it, and I was finding out about prebiotics and probiotics. So probiotics are bacteria, like is found in yogurt and such. And prebiotics is something else. Prebiotics, you could say, is a good soil for the probiotics. So what was interesting, I went to look up what kind of foods have prebiotics. At the top of the list are chicory and dandelion, which are related, and Jerusalem artichokes, then onions and garlic, and then also whole wheat. And not only whole wheat, but unrefined and unprocessed whole wheat. And I was realizing that whenever I'm here in Hawaii, I'm particularly healthy. My digestion works very well. And one of the things we do here in Hawaii is we grind our own wheat fresh, which Srila Prabhupada really wanted, by the way. He said that you shouldn't eat wheat more than 3 days after it's ground. What happens is the wheat germ oil, which contains a lot of vitamin E, starts becoming rancid in the wheat germ after 3 days. And Jamuna said that Prabhupada could tell how soon before being used the wheat had been ground. It was very interesting. The Prabhupada could eat a chapati and say, oh, this wheat was ground today, or this wheat was ground some time ago, you know. And the other place I noticed I was very healthy was I was in Washington, D.C., where the family I was staying with was buying not only all organic produce, but they said to me, we're even buying organic wheat, and they said, we get it from the mill right after it's ground. I just realized this yesterday when I was looking up about prebiotics. I thought, wow, my main source of prebiotics is whole wheat, and my digestion works properly when it's freshly ground. But there are people with a disease called celiac disease, and if they eat whole wheat, they get very sick. So the very thing that nourishes most of us is poison to others. So Ayurveda understands this, that the particular kind of food that nourishes a person may be different from one person to another. You can say this is general food for human consumption, and then you can say this is specific food for specific people. So when you say Balabhadra Prabhu, like-minded, there's a certain kind of like-mindedness for all of us. So any of us who want to be devotees of Krishna, there is a general category of like-mindedness. So anyone who's a religious person is in one sense like-minded. In one sense, in terms of association, there are food. But then it becomes more and more and more specific. So that you find that those who are very realized in their swarup, in their ultimate identity, they want to associate not only with people in their own mood, in their own staiba, but in their own variety of mood. So you find, say, Raghunath Das Goswami and Bhaktivinoda Thakur, they're talking about how they don't want to associate with Radharani's rivals. Even though Radharani's rivals are also in Madhurya Ras, they're also pure devotees, because it's a different flavor. Of course, sometimes they all associate with each other. But none of this is done in the mood of enmity. We do not find that the different groups of gopis, the different groups of cows, etc., they have no enmity with each other. They don't want to cause harm to each other. But they do have, even at the highest level of existence, different types of food that are suitable for them, so to speak. So that's just understanding what is my nature. That's not a question of friends and enemies. Friends and enemies is I want to help you and I want to hurt you. That's friends and enemies.
Thank you very much.
Mother Pramila, we have a question from Anu, who is on Skype. Okay, Mother Anu, you should be able to unmute yourself, and now you can speak.
Hare Krishna.
Yes, we can hear you.
Hare. Actually, I have a question. Hare Krishna.
I can hear you. Go ahead.
One. Go ahead. Hare Krishna. I have one doubt. That is, India is a Bharat place, right? Hare Krishna?
Yes, I hear you.
Yeah. And it's meant for the Prishwa, it's the holy place in India, mostly, following all the rituals and traditional follow-ups. And why it is not attacked in broad countries, that is UK and USA? Why that it's not followed before? It's all totally like a material world, material condition of life. So why it so happened? Because why there is a variation from when compared to India and then the international countries?
Are you asking why India is not as prosperous?
No, it's meant for following the spiritual practice.
What's
and
your...
why it's not? Mostly they used to tell it's in when the plays of UK or America, and there is not it's not a holy place. Sometimes they are not following the rituals and everything. But here are so many places or that is Krishna Leelas or Leelas are conducted here and Krishna Lord Bahan Krishna played so many pastimes in India.
So what is your question?
Yeah, my question is, why is such a difference? I want to know.
Why did Krishna
why
favor India?
Why not happen even in its major role is played here, no? The spiritual practice and all Krishna Leelas and everything, avatarans and everything. And it not concentrate on out of India, like US and UK. But now only it's slowly spreading into spiritual platform. So why it happened, you know?
Okay, I think I understand. I think I understand what you're asking. I think you're asking. Why are people in those places not concentrating and Krishna and well, it's an interesting question. I mean, what we... Okay, well... We... Okay, so... It's an interesting question. You know, why did Krishna favor India? And why do we find the Lord's pastimes, at least in that incarnation of Krishna, happening in India and not in the rest of the world? Of course, Srila Prabhupada in the fourth chapter of Bhagavad Gita says that the Lord incarnates everywhere, not only on Indian soil. He says that the Lord comes himself or as his son or representative and incarnates in all species and in all places, not only in India. So, just like we have Lord Jesus Christ or Muhammad who appeared outside of India. And there certainly is spirituality in places outside of India. To say that, like right now I'm here in America, that there's no real religion is not accurate. There certainly are very many genuinely religious people here in America, even though they're not part of the Vaishnava sampradayas. And similarly, in India, there are many irreligious people. So I don't see it as a black or white situation at all. I mean, there were two Spanish Catholics at the time of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. They lived in Spain. They were practicing Catholicism, and from their books, they certainly appear to be entering into Madhurya Prema. So I don't think we can make some sort of an absolute demarcation that says that real spirituality only occurs in India and doesn't occur outside of India, nor can we say that Krishna only incarnates in India, because Prabhupada specifically says that is not true. Now, let's, putting that aside for a minute, if we look back historically, Srila Prabhupada tells us over and over again that when Krishna was on the planet, the whole world was under one emperor. Even from a geological, scientific point of view, the modern scientists say that the world didn't look the way that it looked today, that the continents were in different places geographically on the globe, that climates were different. There's strong evidence that in Siberia there was a subtropical climate, for example. They find these woolly mammoths that are frozen, and they find subtropical plants in their stomachs, even though now it's just, you know, a wasteland. There's evidence that in most of the deserts of the world, there were originally forests. And Srila Prabhupada frequently says that Vedic culture was all over the world. So if we go back in history, then we're not going to find this kind of big demarcation that in this place called India. In fact, what was India, the whole world was called Bharat. It wasn't just one country. And even the modern country of India used to be much larger, that gradually its territory has been decreased, even just recently cutting out Pakistan and so forth and so on. So when we say that Krishna incarnates in Bharat, that had meant the whole planet. Of course, at the present time, we see that knowledge of Krishna and interest of Krishna is much more prevalent in India and much more prevalent among people of Indian descent than it is in other places or among other ethnicities. And recognizing this, Srila Prabhupada said that it was particularly the duty of the Indians to become Krishna conscious and to spread Krishna consciousness. So the fact that this original Vedic culture has sort of shrunk down now to what we call India geographically is not so surprising. India has become sort of the last bastion. But even in India, I mean, I don't know exactly where you live, but in my visits to India, I see a real mix between a following of Sanatana Dharma and an understanding of these principles and very gross materialism. And in fact, I see some gross materialism in India that is far more gross and far more materialistic than what I see here in Hawaii. So I don't see it as a cut and dried thing. And then Mahaprabhu is predicting that every town and village of the world will resound with the Sankirtan movement. He's not saying that it's going to be limited to India. And we're seeing this already happening, that you can literally go to pretty much, it's getting to be the point that you can go to almost any town or village in the world, and somebody there is engaged in the Sankirtan movement. And this is becoming more and more true, that Krishna consciousness is spreading throughout the world. Now, having said all that, Krishna has his likes and dislikes. He's a person, and he has places he particularly likes to go to, and he manifests his dham in the place geographically that we call India. And that's, of course, when Krishna's dham was fully manifest to everyone 5,000 years ago, India was quite a different place than it is today. When we read the descriptions of India in the Shastra, and then if we go to the present place of India and think we're going to find what it says in the Shastra, we're going to be very gravely disappointed. But Krishna has his likes and dislikes, where he wants to manifest, how he wants to manifest, and why does he manifest his dham on this earth planet at all? Could be asked. This earth planet is the lowest of the middle planetary systems. It's not a particularly important planet in terms of the universe. But still, Krishna wants to have his dham here. He wants to have his eternal spiritual abode here on this earth planet. And it's so important in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, when Gopakumar is traveling throughout the material and spiritual universe, there's a number of times when he's directed to go back to the earth planet, to Mathura Mandala, to Vrindavan Dham, in order to progress to higher realms. And why exactly? I don't think I can answer that question. Why does, you know, it's like saying, why does Krishna primarily play a flute? I'm sure Krishna can play anything. I'm sure Krishna is expert at playing a piano and a bass guitar and any instrument he wants to play. And I'm sure there are times he does play other instruments. But he particularly likes the flute. That's his favorite instrument. Or why does Krishna particularly wear yellow? You know, in our temples, when we dress the deities in all sorts of colors. In fact, you're supposed to dress the deities in different colors for different days of the week, etc. But yet we say Krishna particularly wears a saffrony yellow kind of color. Why does he particularly like that color? Because he's a person. He's a person. He has likes and dislikes. That's part of the definition of being a person. He has things that are special to him and that are favorite to him. And there's not really another explanation besides that in the ultimate sense. Okay?
Well, that was a great answer.
I think we could take one more question.
Dandavat Sarma Didi. You hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, great theme. Good and evil, good and bad. Just really a rich theme. It's seems like a lot of things could be written on this. Like you're saying, there's a lot of movies and stories, and you know, even within the Vedic system, there's the constant struggle between good and evil, and so many stories about the demigods and the demons trying to control things, and the intolerance of it seems like the last leg of religion, truthfulness, is being eroded by, you know, all the attempts of government control and so people are concerned about this, and I think the government's very concerned about a different standard of values. I think Prabhupada mentioned that it would be dangerous if the government actually understood what we were about, you know, because it's one thing to have abstract values. It's another thing to, you know, have this absolute vision. What Krishna is pleasing to Krishna, that's good. It doesn't matter. We actually transcend morality at some point. But anyway, I really liked your class. I liked the theme you chose. I really liked some of your answers at the end. And I don't have a clear question, but it's everywhere. This good and bad, good and evil. So many ways you can talk about it. Great theme.
Oh, thank you, Prabhu. Yeah, I was also thinking about how this good and evil is throughout the Bhagavatam. You know, also to some extent Chaitanya Charitamrita, it's also there to a large extent in Bhagavad Gita. This, you know, the divine and demoniac, this universal struggle between good and evil. And I really like also what you said about that pleasing Krishna is the ultimate good. You know, we follow the rules of morality because they come from Krishna and because generally they please Krishna. But the ultimate truth is to please Krishna. I also like what you said about truthfulness being the last leg of religion. That is the ultimate religion. Because religion is the absolute truth. And ultimate religion, ultimate good, is doing what's true and what's real. Again, ultimately truth is not telling whether or not you ate the cookie. That's not ultimate truth. Ultimate truth is a loving personal relationship with the Supreme Absolute Truth. That is what is ultimately true. And anything that's opposed to that is false, even if something that's opposed to it appears in the relative sense to be something that is true. So thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.